Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Sending in questions and comments, thank you so much. And please continue to help spread the word that each week this show will bring on special guests that can inspire, educate, and in some cases entertain, while bringing answers and options to making our lives happier, healthier, and more successful. And we will introduce you to top professionals and talented authors who are working to make this world a better place for all of us. Now, I would really appreciate if you would all do me a big favor. Please forward one of our shows to your social media group and to someone you know can benefit from today's show. And I guarantee we all know someone that can benefit from today's show. Now, this is one powerful way that we, together, can make a positive difference in the world. Now, unfortunately, with all the negativity and divisiveness out there these days, I hope that you will find answersforthefamily.com to be a place you can go to see and hear some of the good and great things that are happening in this world today. And with that in mind, if there was ever a time in recent years that we needed to focus on gratitude, this is the time. Well, my son, Chase, and I wrote the Attitude of Gratitude Journal, something that at the time was geared towards teens going through some changes in their life. Well, we're all going through changes in our lives now. So please go to our website at answersforthefamily.com and download a free copy. It is our gift to you. All I ask is that you subscribe, which is for free, and we won't send you a bunch of stuff, and give it 21 days and comment on whatever platform you listen to us on, what focusing on gratitude has meant for you and your family. Now, a quote that is not in the journal, but should be, is by our guest. And that quote is, "Love is a feeling, and like any feeling, it can come and go. Loving is a skill set and one that you can develop." Now, with that, you can probably imagine our topic today is one of my favorites. It's love. Our guest, Linda Carroll, is the author of two excellent books, Love Skills and Love Cycles. And even though she has worked as a therapist and couples coach for over three decades and has acquired numerous certificates and degrees along the way, she says that her own 35-year marriage is the primary source of her knowledge when it comes to the cycles of love. Linda, welcome to Answers for the Family.
Well, thank you. I'm so glad to be here. It's been, my marriage has been my experimental canvas with which I've tried out all the things that I teach and learn. And some of them I threw out because they didn't really work well. So I think that it's given me a great sense of humility, for one thing, mm-hmm. about how hard it can be to be in a relationship at times, especially this time. One of the things that I wrote something in my newsletter about how when my husband and I first fell in love, that first stage, I said to him, I would love nothing more than to be on a desert island with you, just trapped for months. Well, mm-hmm. guess what? We've just finished our fifth month of quarantine together. Yes. And so we laugh about that now after 35 years. And, you know, some of it's been, I mean, I'm certainly glad to be doing it with him and not somebody else, but it's also been really hard at times because the things that bring us together is often our differences, and those get exaggerated so much when we're locked in together on a desert island, which most of us are with our kids, with our partners. And so anyway, with that, I'm glad to be here.
Well, thank you to you and your husband for going through all of these things so that you could then share with us so that many of us can learn from it and not have to make the same mistakes.
I hope it's going to be that easy. Just read the book and you'll just all get enlightened, right?
Yeah. Maybe not completely enlightened, but we will at least get enough information that we will know how to get through those times when they hit. And that's what I got from the book.
I think, you know, I think that's that the book is the book I wish I had had when I was 16 and 17 and 22. So I think I wrote that book for,
So now one of the things that you talk about in the book Love Skills, is you talk about love as an inside job. So explain a little bit about your meaning in regards to that.
Yeah, I'm happy to. I think a couple of things I can say about that is that, first of all, I think that anybody who has gotten to the age of 25, maybe younger, realizes that we can't change anybody. Mm-hmm. You know, we can only, the only work we can really do is on ourselves. Nobody can be coerced, loved into, convinced into doing something differently. And so for most of us, especially when we're under stress, we look out at our relationship and what we see is the other person. We don't see ourselves in it. And yet the only change we can make is within ourselves. And sometimes that change within ourselves, it really creates something that shifts the relationship. Sometimes it doesn't, but we don't really have an option because I don't know anybody who's ever successfully changed another person. Do you?
Yeah, no. You know, I even talk about that as it relates to even our own children, that, you know, we only have a certain amount of influence on them. And, you know, and one of the things that when I speak on that subject is I say, you know, we have a much smaller level of influence, I think, as it relates to helping them on the right path than we have the opportunity, the possibility of really messing things up. So
That's right. You know, we certainly have more control over changing our kids' behavior. I remember I had an aunt and I couldn't stand going to her house. We had to go there on Thanksgiving. And I always, you know, my parents said, you have to come. So I did have to go, but I made it the most miserable day of the year for me, for them. And I think about, I look back, I mean, I feel bad that I did that now, but I look back and I think about that you can get somebody to do something, but to actually create that change inside is something that we have to do for ourselves. And so love is an inside job because the skills that we need in all of our relationships, not just with a partner, they have to come from within us. They don't really come because somebody does something we want. It comes from something in me that chooses to respond in a certain way.
And I think that goes right into the quote that I started with, because I just thought it was so beautiful that I wanted to add it to the introduction. But talk a little bit about the difference between love and loving.
Love is a feeling. And those feelings come and they go all the time. You know, in an hour we feel, I mean, most of us, especially in the world it is now, may feel anger and sadness and fear and joy. Those feelings, I think of that feelings are like clouds. You know, they come and they pass over unless we embellish them, unless we hold on to them. But they're feelings, and falling in love is a big feeling. But loving, if it's based on feeling, we're in trouble. Because in 35 years, I've had every feeling towards my husband that's possible to have, and not all of them are love, you know, and yet the relationship is based on the skill of responding from a way that is not reactive in the most loving way I can most of the time. And one of the things I want to say about that right away is that loving doesn't mean you don't have good boundaries. Mm-hmm. It means you can say no. But you can say also how you can have a no and a yes, but the no isn't against the other person. It's for yourself. So even that skill, even the skill of a no, can be done from a place of kindness. I don't always hit the mark, by the way.
Yeah, but I think also what you're saying is that from the standpoint of us taking things too personally, you know, from the standpoint, you know, is the no against us? I think that if we take it, it's against us, as opposed to being against the activity the, you know, whatever it may be that the no is fitting. It's, you know, this really isn't against you personally, but I think we get caught up a lot in those types of things by thinking that, you know, it's now a personal attack because they said no to us.
That's true. That's right. So it takes a lot of self-understanding and self-work to be able to hear a no and not personalize it too. Mm-hmm. How do we work out? And especially now during this crazy time, yes, where we're having to create, I mean, one of the things that I'm working with couples all the time, I have a full-time, now it's a Zoom practice. But one of the biggest issues has to do with safety and where mm-hmm. people create boundaries in their safety and where is the no and where is the yes, because what we're doing impacts the other person so much. That's very tricky how to work that out. And so, I mean, some things are not tricky. I think that I'm suggesting to people that they find something fairly in the middle of the road, like the Red Cross or the CDC, and look at what the guidelines are for how to stay safe. But yeah, even within that, there are people who are really, who are risk adverse, and people who push the envelope, even though they're staying within those guidelines. And even that creates trouble. So how do you work that out? How do you work boundaries when what you do affects your partner so much?
Yes, exactly. And I think it also comes down to kindness, you know, from the standpoint of the way in which you deal with something, because I think that as people are talking about, which is a great point, what we're going through now, people are saying, you know, you should do this, you shouldn't do that. And you know, the media is doing one thing. And like you said, the CDC or WHO are saying something else. If you start from a place of kindness, in the sense that, you know, I'm not going to attack their belief, you know, and I'm not going to make it wrong, you know, I think that if we start from that point, and I had a discussion recently with a family member, and we look at it from almost a completely opposite approach. But like you said, we found some middle ground that we can agree on. Okay, but we agree this, you know, or we can agree that, you know, better safe than sorry, you know.
Well, how do you agree if somebody says we need to wear a mask and social distance and the other person says, no, we don't, we're fine? How do you do that?
Yeah, well, in that particular situation, I think that because it's, you know, you don't sweat the little things, you go ahead and just wear it. You know, I mean, from that standpoint, it is, you know, I'm going to do this for you. I'll give you an example. I was in line at the UPS store. So I was shipping something out.
Yes.
And those of us, there's a sign on the door that says, wear a mask. So I'm just going to wear a mask. And as I'm wearing the mask and I'm in line, and there's a gentleman close to my age that's in front of me. And the young man that's waiting on us, there are two people servicing us. There's two people waiting on each person. One was older, wearing a mask. One was younger that wasn't. And as the man, before he would walk up, the man in front of me, he said to the young man, can you please put on a mask? You know, I'm approaching you, but can you please put on a mask? And the young man said, don't worry about it. I'm fine. I'm young. This isn't going to bother me.
Oh my gosh.
And, you know, and so on.
What a question. What a response.
And the man in front of me started to get angry, you know, and he started to raise his voice. And I just said, excuse me for a minute. May I interject? And they both stopped and looked at me. And I looked at the young man and I said, do you realize that the wearing of the mask, if you wear it, you're doing a kind service to us. And if I do it, I'm doing a kind service to you. So if you take that in mind, because you're young, we could probably not have to wear a mask one-on-one with you and everything would be okay. But we're asking you to do it, you know, for us. And besides, you know, you have a sign on the door that tells everybody to. And then the older man that works there looked at the young guy and said, you know, yes, please, you know, go in the back, grab your mask, put it on, and so on. But it was just from the standpoint of saying, you know, let's just do this out of kindness rather than try and argue the points. You know, I may not necessarily agree, you know, with the man in front of me or the young person, but it doesn't matter at that point. We can all just come to an agreement that we're going to do this for now until we know different.
I love that. I think, you know, that reminds me of a friend of mine who has she has an amazing approach of kindness. And about 15 years ago, we were in the parking lot of a restaurant, and there was a man with a little girl. He was about three, and he had his hands on her shoulders. He was shaking her, and he was screaming at her, and he was saying, "Why did you do that? Why did you do that?" And of course, the three-year-old was totally freaked out and couldn't come up with any answers. And I wanted to go, and my response was, I wanted to go shake the man.
Exactly.
And my friend, who was much wiser, actually went up to him, and she said to him, "It can be so hard with kids sometimes, can't it?" She said, "It can be really, really hard." And the guy just started to cry. And he said, "It is hard. I don't know what to do." She just threw the food on the floor in the restaurant. So my friend, who's a therapist like I am, sort of interacted with him in a very gentle way. And within a very short amount of time, he said to the little girl, "I'm sorry, I yelled at you." And it was much more effective than me, who was going to go shake him. But it was part of what you're talking about, is that if you're approaching with kindness and certainty about what you're saying, so that it's not kindness that's sort of, it's not weak kindness, it's strength of kindness.
Right,
isn't it?
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's not fluff, you know. If it comes off as fluff, people just kind of roll their eyes on you.
Yes, That's right. It comes off as strength. That's lovely.
So when I learned about your book and started reading Love Skills, then I learned about love cycles as I started to learn more about you. So then I went in and started reading Love Cycles. And one of the things that I loved was that you go pretty deep into five stages of lasting love. Can you share the stages? And obviously, we probably can't go into all of them in great detail, but just share the stages and why they're so important and why we all pretty much go through them.
Well, I think that they're true. And as I go through them, I also want to say that I think people also go through these stages in new jobs. They go through these stages, you know, we go through them when we fall in, except I think with dogs, we're always in stage one. I'm always in stage one with my dog. But I think that there, you know, I remember a woman coming up to me after I gave a lecture on stages who said, I run a law firm and just about every new attorney goes through these stages. And I think that the cycles, they're cycles of life. They're seasons, really. And they're based, and my work is based on so many other people's work through the ages, including poets, but it goes through the stages. The first is the merge. In our culture, especially, the merge is when we fall madly in love and we feel like we found our other half. We feel like this person just represents the best part of us, and the ways we're different, also we romanticize those parts. So even though we love something, so for instance, my husband is a New Zealander and an outdoors person and he's into fitness and he's into adventure. I'm from San Francisco. I grew up with restaurants. I grew up going to plays. I grew up thinking tomatoes came from Safeway, and he grew up with a father who gardened. And so even those differences were exciting and they were sexy and they were juicy. And in the merge, we make everything work, everything fit. And it's mediated by hormones, chemicals. You know, the old stories of Cupid, Cupid's mother, who was the goddess of love, she would say to Cupid, and she would say, he would have his arrow, she'd say, "Nail that person," and he'd shoot an arrow into the person. Aphrodite was her name. He'd shoot the arrow, and when the person was struck by Cupid's arrow, what would happen? Well, what we know now is actually it's true. When you're struck by the arrow of love, your body is filled with all kinds of chemicals and hormones. Your brain changes. Mm-hmm. So that feeling of love is euphoric. It is this sense of what I call confirmation bias, where everything proves this is just the right person. And it lasts about 3 years the first time. Every time you fall in love, it has diminishing returns. So I now sometimes I see people who are in their 50s that say, "You know, I want to be in love all the time, but it lasts only about 4 months now. How come?" Because each time we fall in love, it's less and less. And so it's meant not to last forever, that feeling. You have a question?
I'm shocked.
What are you shocked at?
No. This is the first that I've heard about. I've never heard about the concept of diminishing returns.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That's why people get stuck up in their high school or college lovers that they separate and it never completed that, and they never got to do a real relationship. So what happens is the chemicals wear off, and it's sort of like that's the boat that gets us to the river of, and if we're smart enough, if we've had good attachment in our, and if we have sort of wisdom, we can select a partner who can go the distance at the beginning. Sometimes we can't, because those chemicals, they really are not about relationship compatibility necessarily. They're about all kinds of other things, but that's in the book. But
Are we talking about endorphins?
Yeah, we're talking about phenylethylalamine. We're talking about oxytocin, which is the cuddle chemical. We're talking about a reduction of serotonin, which creates something that's like obsessive compulsive disorder, which is certainly like being in love, isn't it? It's all you think about. And as they start to wear off, we start to realize that we are not with the perfect other half, that this person who is going to be our other half actually isn't so much like us. We move into the power struggle. I call that doubt and denial in the book, but it's really the power struggle where we think, you know, you're not really totally like me. In fact, in some ways, we're not alike at all. So how are we going to work this out? Money, sex. The research is that if you take that all couples, I say all couples, but couples who are in sort of the normal line of trouble, that if you take them and line them up, you find that all couples have about 10 irresolvable issues, and they're the same issues. And the couples who thrive and the couples who dive have the same amount of issues. They're the same issues, but it's how they handle them that has to do with whether they thrive or dive. But what, you know, the issues: money, sex, kids, animals, work, house cleaning, how all of that kind of stuff, vacation, families, blah, blah, blah. So we start to, those issues come up as power struggles. And most of us didn't learn the skills growing up, how to manage the differences. And so when we're stressed, we go into fight, freeze, flee, or fold. So we move from being totally open, vulnerable, generous, you know, being happy with how the other person does things, to a place where we're now in the power struggle. And what that does, it creates a fight or flight response. And then we go into what I call loops, or the power struggle. And that's stage two. And if we don't have the skills to navigate that, one of the things is that some of those wonderful warm feelings of love start to get reduced. And instead we're into reactivity and anger and feeling our feelings are hurt. We stay in that for a certain amount of time, but we can't live. Sometimes we get stuck in those loops and we start to think the whole relationship is a loop, is a power struggle. My husband and I had an expression years ago when we were in the power struggle, which went on for a long time. And the expression was everything. And it was everything is trouble. We can't even agree on what to eat. I suddenly want to become a vegetarian. You know, he suddenly wants to do something completely different with our vacations. It's like everything is trouble.
And as you're mentioning everything, one of the stories that you talk about in the book that I think really hammers that point down is when you talk about the dishes.
You know, I did the whole, it sounds funny when people talk about it, because when we met each other, the first conversation we had was this sort of cute fight over how to do the dishes. And it was sort of fun. But over the years, it still goes on to this day. That's been 40 years now. And we still have trouble with how we do the dishes. In fact, I could actually use the rest of the time to explain why he's wrong, but I know better. And because we just don't pay attention. The one who does the dishes does it their way. But we had some powerful, hard moves during that. And that goes into the third stage, which is really disenchantment. That's the stage. If stage one is enchantment, stage three is disenchantment. Everything is wrong. And confirmation bias, which confirms all the reasons that we're perfect for each other. In the third stage, we're not only not one, as my one of my teachers, Harville Hendricks, says, stage one is we two are one, and stage two and three are we two are one, and I'm the one. So we move from being the perfect whole to moving apart to actually sometimes turning our backs on each other in stage three because nothing seems to work. And everything comes sort of evidence that this isn't working. I'm with the wrong person. People get sick of that. They get tired of living in pain. We close off our hearts. That kindness you talk about often is the last thing we can find. And at that point, we move into doing something. Whatever it is, people may leave each other, or they may go into parallel lives where they just close themselves off and they say, well, we're going to stay together, but I'm not going to keep myself vulnerable to you. Or they say, what are we going to, let's do something different. And I love it that people come more and more to me. When I started doing my practice about 38 years ago, the people I saw were on death's door of relationship, but I see all kinds of people now who are in a good relationship. They say, we don't know how to fight very well. We don't know how to manage a power struggle. We want to keep this good. How do we do it? And that's very exciting for me as a therapist. That's where we learn skill. And that's where we learn we don't have to let go of the feeling of love, even if we're angry. But that's a very advanced skill. It takes a lot of practice to do that. But the skills are how to navigate those difficult seasons, those difficult times, and still keep connected. Because here's the thing I found. That for most normal trouble, and I say normal because there's some trouble that isn't normal. Yeah. It's off the chart, like people who hit each other or who take money from their retirement to gamble it away. That kind of thing, which is a different, that addictions, that needs a different kind of care. But for people who are in normal trouble, that the skill really lets us be in some of those spaces where we are not in agreement, where we're actually threatened by what the other person is saying or doing, but we know how to manage those in ways that don't harm love. And I call that the black belt of relationship, where your partner is saying something very threatening to you. And instead of closing yourself off from them, you can stay open and still stay clear about where you're at. Because here's what I found is that the most painful part of what people talk about as their trouble is really not, do we get a dog? Do we not get a dog? How do we handle sex? I have more of a libido than you do. That isn't really the trouble. The trouble is, as we talk about those things, I've lost you. Where did you go? I've lost my best friend. So instead of these people of feeling like we're each other's half, we're turned away from each other. And the skill is getting to wholehearted. And wholehearted, I love the model of wholehearted where it's you're whole. You never were not whole to begin with. And I'm whole. And where we come together, we make a third body, a third person. But it's not, my wholeness isn't dependent on you, nor is your wholeness dependent on me.
We're talking with Linda Carroll. Her book is called Love Skills. And actually, if you get love skills, go back a little bit further and get Love Cycles as well, because it is also a great book. But we're going to take a break. We'll be right back. Stay with us. You're listening to Answers for the Family.
Founded over 30 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, Westshield has continually focused on resolving issues that negatively impact families and businesses. Our signature therapeutic transportation service helps to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely transported to specialized schools, programs, and treatment centers with unsurpassed experience and success. We are supported by our full-service licensed investigation agency that has legally, professionally, and compassionately located hundreds of runaways and teens. We are experienced and qualified to help, offering solutions which may include referrals to our international network of top professionals in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, psychiatry, and investigations. Simply put, West Shield Adolescent Services and West Shield Investigations are the best solutions when your family is facing a personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. That's 1-800-899-8585, or visit our website at westshield.com. Thank you.
And we're back. You're listening to Answers for the Family. With us is Linda Carroll, and her books are Love Skills and Love Cycles. And if you're just now tuning in, we just touched on something that really covers a lot of ground, but it was going through those cycles. Now, Linda, I kind of renamed the first cycle when I was taking notes, when I was reading your book and taking notes. I called the first cycle lust.
Yeah.
And then she has, as far as the second stage or cycle, is doubt and denial. Then it is disillusionment. And that's the part that really concerns me. And then it's decision. And then where you just ended before we went to break, which is wholehearted loving. I'm just so appreciative that you have not only written the book, but that you're out there and you're talking about it and teaching this, because I think so many of us don't get past, you know, three or four, that it becomes insurmountable to us to get past that. And, you know, it's sort of that light at the end of the tunnel, to where it just by knowing that makes us, I think, want to go, okay, if I just push through this, I'm going to get to that fifth stage. And if I get to that fifth stage, we're going to be okay. Not that it means everything's going to be rosy, but at least we're going to be able to make this work.
That's right. Because in the fifth stage, where you're whole and you have enough of the skills, we're always learning the skills, but there's a way that there's much more goodwill. You know, a couple of weeks ago, my husband and I had this argument about something, and it was about our dog. And it was, and we got really heated about it. And every time we'd start to talk about it during the day, we would melt down with each other. And at the end of the day, he said, "I have this great idea." I said, "What?" You know, even though I write this, I'm not always in this state of euphoric love. I said, "What?" He said, "What if we just hug each other and don't talk?" And I said, "That's really good." And we did. And we started laughing, because that's one of the things that closes down, is that physical connection. But even though we weren't in agreement about something, he wanted to take the dog on a river trip. And I mean, it was sort of, you know, and I'm very risk averse anyway. Even though we were in disagreement, and I was full of fear and he was full of feeling controlled about our dog, blah, 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 is when we were able to feel each other physically, and we could laugh at how stupid it was that we had to disconnect just because we had a different point of view. And actually, he did take the dog, and he agreed to do something that was so different for him, which was to get a life jacket. So our little Australian Labradoodle went out on a boat with a big life jacket that was probably bigger than him. But we couldn't even have gotten to that if we had stayed in lockdown.
See, I love that. I mean, you came to something that, you know, that was workable, you know, and I think that's part of what a relationship is. You know, can you find something that we can both, although it's not perfect for either one of us, it is something that we can both be happy with.
Yeah, that's right.
Now, one of the things that I like about the book is sort of like a workbook. At least I kind of envisioned it that way, where I felt like, okay, I'm getting another tool. You know, wow, here's another tool. And one of the things you do in the book is you encourage the readers to make a genogram in the book. So explain to everybody what a genogram is and why it's so important.
Well, it's the genogram is looking at history of our family, not the history that we grew up with, but it's really looking, going back two or three generations, and seeing what some of the ideas that they had about everything from money to expression of feelings, mm-hmm. to sex, to touch, to dogs, where some of those attitudes came from. And it gives us such a different understanding of some of our own attitudes, for example, and also an understanding of them. And for example, if you were a person who immigrated and came here, especially during times of persecution, and I have a foundation that works with migrants right now, and I know something about those people that just leave everything because they're afraid they're going to get killed. Mm-hmm. That there is a certain way that the trauma is so huge that you have to close off your feelings, close off yourself. You don't talk about it. And a lot of times people, my clients will say, well, I don't even know what it was like for my father growing up, or I don't know anything about my grandmother's history. And sometimes it's because it was so painful that it wasn't a question of being closed. It was a question of survival. That's just a small example. But getting a sense of the stories that are passed down to us, not in story form, but in attitudes and beliefs, can be very liberating in looking at where we got a lot of our ideas.
You know, along those lines, and I think you will know what I'm talking about. I apologize to those people that won't know. I was having a conversation with a 30-year-old, and they were talking about the state of the world right now. And we were both talking about it, and we were having a great conversation. But I felt like they kept coming back to the fact that we've somehow created something that is so horrific that the world has never seen this. You know, that and in this day and age, during this virus crisis, we're spending a lot more time at home, which means watching things like Netflix and Amazon Prime and stuff. And I said to them, I said, do me a favor. I said, go on. And I forget which one of those two it's on, Amazon or Netflix. And I said, I want you to watch a show called Laugh-In. Mm-hmm. And they looked at me and they went, they'd never heard of it, but I don't understand. And I said, just do me a favor. I said, watch a season of it. So just, you know, first season, second season, I don't care. Watch a season of it. And they said, why? I don't understand. I said, what you will find is that it's a show that is 50 years old. And what you will find is the same thing is going on. It's based around humor, but they are talking about corruption in government. They are talking about race issue. They are talking about the polluting the waters, polluting the air. I go, they're talking about the same thing. This is 50 years ago. So, you know, your belief that this is something that whatever politician is telling you that they're somehow going to fix this, and that they've told you that this is the first time this has ever happened and that this is the worst thing that's ever happened, you need to learn something about history. So that's what I liked when I was reading your book and you were talking about the genogram. And I went, I love this because it is having people go back to see what's in your personal history.
I had a client once who had a pretty good childhood. It wasn't great, but it was good enough. And he loved his dad. And his dad did everything, came to all his games, but he always had a feeling his dad was disappointed in him. Because mm-hmm. we make up stories about things, and stories we act as though they're true. So his story was, he was a middle kid, and his older brother was more clever, and his dad was not particularly warm with him, even though he showed up. And he had this story that he wasn't good enough. So when we did the genogram, he talked about his dad's story, and he talked about that his dad was gone. He was in a war, and it was this was World War II. This was a long time ago. But this is when I really got how important it was. And he said, well, I said, what did he do in the war? He said, well, I don't know. He was just gone for a few years. I said, find out. Mm-hmm. So his dad had died, but he came back to me the next week and he was really shaken. He said, my dad was in a POW camp for 3 years and no one talked about it. And his idea that his father's remoteness, here was this guy, the greatest generation. In those days, we didn't know about PTSD. People just came back and they were lucky. They felt lucky to be alive and they got on with it. Some of them flipped out and some of them, like his dad, became dutiful. They did the right thing, but they were so broken inside. And he had made a story that that remoteness was because he was somehow not okay. Right. And when he learned that, it changed everything in his life. And so genneagrams help us really get a sense not only of who our parents were or our grandparents, I have them go back a few generations, but some of the ways that we've made sense of our history really have nothing to do with the stories we tell ourselves. Isn't that a story?
Yeah, really. Now, and I was just looking at, we've got about 7 minutes or so, but okay. Tell us about, share with everybody the pause. Okay. The pause. I love the fact that you've set up this acronym and how it can help us create a better relationship. And I love the fact that it happens to spell pause.
Well, the first thing about the pause is that it is about mindfulness. Yeah. Mindfulness is about pausing. It's about learning not to react, but to respond. And that means take a minute. One of the things I talk about in communication is that the intensity with which you feel you need to say something to your partner has very seldom anything to do with the wisdom of saying it right then. And anybody who's ever shot an email off or a text off and then thinks, what did I do, knows exactly what I, and that's probably most of us, what did I do? So the pause is really, it's about five elements of communication. And I break that down to presence through learning how to really listen and learning to use the word and instead of but. The undefended communication, if we're defensive, how that gets in the way of relationship, how we speak with skill and intention, and E is for emotional intelligence, the really important part about understanding ourselves and the power that our emotions have in relationship. But the bottom line of all of it, it's about taking a breath first and monitoring ourselves. It all begins with me. And so how I'm responding or how I'm reacting has everything to do with what my partner says. The first, how we present a conversation, how we bring it up has everything to do with what happens. If I start by saying, I can't believe you said that at a dinner party, my partner is not going to say, oh, please share. I'm so happy you told me how upset you were. If I bring that up in such a way that starts out by making them defensive, how we start it has everything to do with how it finishes. And sometimes it finishes immediately by them just doing that.
Sure. And I think that's good advice for almost any type of communication with anyone. I mean, in this day and age of so much incivility, that if we could just start out by taking a pause, what's a more civil way to approach this? I think we could improve a lot of things.
I do too.
So we have a couple of listener questions. I want to get them in. And again, I want to thank those that take the time to do this. I know that people, have a lot of choices and stuff. When you take the time to write these, I do everything I can to get these in and really appreciate them. Now, this one reads, my husband and I are in our fifth year of marriage, and slowly over time, his funny teasing has switched to a degrading and downright mean tone. And he does it with this, ha, 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 just kidding, when I ask him to think about how his comments make me feel. He says, I'm overreacting and I've lost my sense of humor. I've suggested a few times that we go to a counselor, and he rolls his eyes, immediately gets indignant and has the audacity to repeatedly call me the drama queen. I love my husband, but this is infuriating and he knows it. Short of threatening a divorce, what can one in this circumstance do? And this is from Gracie in Alabama.
Well, I think that Gracie in Alabama and her husband are caught in the power struggle. And what's happening now is that they're acting out what is not getting worked out. He is protesting by sarcasm. Right. We need to be able to protest and repair. And they're stuck in somewhere where there's no protest. So one of the things that Gracie can do is when he does that, is she can say, that really hurts my feelings. And I'm not going to keep on with this. And eventually she can actually say, when you do that, I'm going to leave the room, not because I'm trying to punish you, because it's hurtful. If he escalates it, she's got to make a different decision about what she's willing to tolerate. You know, this may be, that it's a very complicated question, because right. all kinds of things can be going on. But I think what's really going on is they're in a power struggle, and it's not coming out directly what it's about. So he's talking about it in his lingo, which is sarcasm and shaming. And she's now reacting to that. But that's not the real issue. There's something right. else going on.
Yeah. So it sounds like stage three.
Sounds like they're going to get to stage three, some hard moves pretty fast, if they don't get some help, or if she isn't. The other thing about it is talking about it when they're not in it.
I love that.
When he's not sarcastic, when she's in sarcasm, he's also escalated. She can just walk out of the room. But later on, sitting down to a dinner or going out somewhere in a good place, and to say in a way that's not shaming, you know, I think that there's a way that maybe you're upset about something. I'd like to hear it. But to not, to somehow, if you go into correcting someone's behavior when they're in the behavior, you're going to get opposition.
I'm so glad that you shared that. I wish I would have been smart enough at a much younger age to have figured that one out. But that is one of the ones to where, when I think of some of the dumber things that I've done, and that's usually been just that, is I have spoken harshly while in the moment. When you mentioned leaving, and God, I can't believe I'm going to share this, but when being told something where I was being blamed for something and in essence kind of being yelled at or whatever, I did the I'm going to walk out of the room, only I couldn't resist. And a parting shot that was just horrible. And said, I'm not going to sit here and have this conversation in crazy town. I'm going to leave the room and we'll come back and talk about it another time. You know, it's like I want to go, like one of the dumbest things I could have said, which obviously I'm sure you know didn't make it any better. So yes, the idea of being able to wait and pick it up another time, I think is so helpful. So I think we've got time. Let me get one more in real quick. This one says, so please tell me what is the validity of saying the 7-year itch? It says, I think I have it. Tom is my second significant partner in life, and we both came to the relationship with 2 kids each, 10 to 16 years of age. They are now grown and out of the nest, and we are now finding that we have virtually nothing in common. I want to travel. He doesn't. I love gardening and outdoors. He doesn't. I'm feeling this pull to change my life and maybe find someone who wants to explore life, not sit on the couch and watch sports all weekend. My mother in her 90s says I'm being selfish and is putting a guilt trip on me. Does your book talk about situations like ours? Would it Yes. bring a new perspective to our dilemma? And this is from Virginia in Los Angeles.
My book does. When I talk about wholehearted, because we and differentiation, the bottom line of every relationship is I have to live in my life the way my husband and I couldn't be more different, really. But we have found so many ways how to now, after a lot of power struggles, how to give each other a lot of room to do the things we love, which gives us. But this is a very complicated. There are no quick answers. You know, why is he sitting on the couch all the time? Is he depressed? You know, is he in some kind of physical pain? How much room do they give each other to do the things they love? You know, I love to go often to cities and restaurants, and he doesn't. We give each other a lot of space to do that, but we don't have to do it together. And somehow, this isn't Dear Abby. People are complicated. Yeah. And very complicated. And so if she says, I still love my husband, I'd get to that and say, what does she love about him? How does it work that's good? And are they able to have a conversation where there is enough flexibility in the relationship that if he wants to sit on the couch and she wants to go off with her friends for a weekend to do something, an adventure, can the relationship support that?
Mm-hmm. Which kind of goes to what you said right when we started. Is we don't really change people.
No,
so that's right. Figure out a way to make it work. Linda, thank you so much for coming on. I really just want to acknowledge you for being able to put this information out there, and the fact that you coach so much from your own personal experience. And it shows in the, it shows in the book and when you read it, because you have the little anecdotal things that you bring in, so that if someone else reading it, we can look at it and say, you know, this isn't just something that came out of a textbook. This is, you know, she's lived it, she's sharing it, and hopefully we're going to be able to learn from it. So again,
somebody once said, if they can do it, anyone can do it.
I like that too.
Thank you so much. That's
so great. Again, so for everybody out there, now the book, is it anywhere where you can buy books, right?
Yes. Anywhere you can buy books, Love Cycles and
Love Skills
by right. Linda Carroll. So
yeah. And then also, you can also get more information by going to Linda's website. So it's Linda Carroll.
Linda A. Carroll.
Okay. So LindaACarroll.com. If you're driving, don't try to write this down. Go to our site, answersforthefamily.com. We will make sure that that it's on there. So Linda, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. It's been great.
All right. Thanks.
Bye-bye. Thanks.
And for everybody out there, now, many of us are experiencing grief as we navigate the current world circumstances, but it doesn't have to paralyze us with fear or inaction. So be sure to put us on your calendar and tune in next Monday when best-selling author, international speaker, and psychotherapist Patty Ashley, PhD, shines a light on how we can emerge from these trying times with hope and transform grief and fear into love and grace. Gotta listen to that one. Now, and please, if you get a chance, visit our archives of past interviews at answersforthefamily.com. If you go to the site, you can type in a word, whatever it is that you are thinking about or concerned with. We've probably had an incredible expert on the show that has spoken about that. You can also subscribe to the show through iTunes, iHeartRadio, Stitcher, YouTube, Spreaker, or SoundCloud. If you like what you hear, please leave a review. It will help us reach more people and be greatly appreciated. So, for everybody out there, please just be kind to each other and be with us next week on Answers for the Family.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza, right here on LA Talk Radio.